A hot day, stagnant, humid. By normal English standards, really hot, insufferably hot. Not that England has standards about such things anymore. Global warming, no doubt. But it's a commonplace about growing old that there seem to be no standards anymore. The dog days, with everything gone to the dogs. Cheerless thoughts to be having on a pleasure jaunt, or what used to be one. For years now, we've usually managed to treat for ourselves on really hot days at home in the summer. We take the car along the bypass road from Oxford for a mile or two and twist abruptly onto the verge. Sometimes there are hoots and shouts from passing cars who have to brake at speed, but by that time we have jolted to a stop, locked the car, and crept through a gap in the hedge. We trailed slowly over the long field toward the river. The heat seemed worse than ever, although the sun, overcast, did not beat down as fiercely as it had done earlier in the day. The hay had been carried away some time before, and the brownish surface of the field was baked hard and covered incongruously with molehills. The earth in them was like grey powder, and I wondered how the moles ever managed to find any sustenance as they tunnelled within it. A pair of crows flapped lazily away as we approached the river bank. Crows are said to live a long time, and I wondered if they were the same birds we'd seen there on our bathing visits for many years past. I wished we'd managed to come earlier, before the hay was cut, and when wild flowers stretched over the whole field among the grass. It was not a lush river field, probably because a bed of gravel lay just below the surface. There were big gravel ponds not far away by the main road, but this field was a protected area, a plant and bird sanctuary of some kind. Not a fish sanctuary, however. There were sometimes a few fishermen about who kept themselves to themselves and remained almost invisible among the reeds. Our own little nook was seldom occupied, however, and it was empty as usual today. Once we would have got our clothes off as soon as possible and slid silently into the water, as we had done on that first occasion. Now I had quite a struggle getting Iris's clothes off. I'd managed to put her bathing dress on at home before we started. Her instinct nowadays seems to be to take her clothes off as little as possible. Even in this horribly hot weather, it is hard to persuade her to remove trousers and jersey before getting into bed. She protested, gently, though vigorously, as I levered off the outer layers. In her shabby old one-piece swimsuit, she was an awkward and anxious figure, her socks trailing round her ankles. She was obstinate about not taking these off, and I gave up the struggle. A pleasure barge chugged slowly past, an elegant girl in a bikini sunning herself on the deck, a young man in white shorts at the steering wheel. Both turned to look at us with a slight air of incredulity. I should not have been surprised if they'd burst into guffaws of ill-mannered laughter, for we must have presented a comic spectacle, an elderly man struggling to remove the garments from an old lady, still with white skin and incongruously fair hair. Alzheimer sufferers are not always gentle, I know that. But Iris remains her old self in many ways. The power of concentration is gone, along with the ability to form coherent sentences and to remember where she is or has been. She doesn't know she has written 27 remarkable novels, as well as her books on philosophy, received honorary doctorates from the major universities, become a dame of the British Empire. If an admirer or friend asks her to sign a copy of one of her novels, she looks at it with pleasure and surprise before laboriously writing her name. It takes her some time, but the letters are still formed with care and resemble, in a surreal way, her old handwriting. She is always anxious to oblige, and the old gentleness remains. Once in the water, Iris cheers up a bit. It is almost too warm, hardly refreshing, but its old brown, slow-flowing deliciousness remains, and we smile happily at each other as we paddle to and fro. Once, if there had been little river traffic about, we would have swum at once the 100 yards or so across the river and back. Now it is too much trouble, and a possible producer of that omnipresent anxiety of Alzheimer's, which spreads to the one who looks after the sufferer. Not that it would be dangerous. Iris still swims as naturally as a fish. Since we first entered the water here together, we have swum in the sea, in lakes and rivers, pools and ponds, whenever we could and wherever we happened to be. I remember the first time we did it, nearly 45 years ago. We were on bicycles then, and there was little traffic on the unimproved road. Nor did we know where the river was exactly. We just thought it must be somewhere there. And with the ardour of comparative youth, we wormed our way through the rank grass and sedge until we almost fell into it, or at least a branch of it. Crouching in the shelter of the reeds, we tore our clothes off and slipped in like water rats. A kingfisher flashed past our noses as we lay soundless in the dark, sluggish current. A moment after we had crawled out and were drying ourselves on Iris's waist slip, a big pleasure boat chugged past within a few feet of the bank. The steersman, wearing a white cap, gazed intently ahead. Tobacco smoke mingled with the watery smell at the roots of the tall reeds. I still have the waist slip. I rediscovered it the other day, bunched up at the back of a drawer, stiff with powdery traces of dry mud. It is faded to a yellowish colour, with a wrinkled ribbon, once blue, decorating the hem. Could someone, later my wife, have indeed once worn such a garment? It looks like something preserved from the wardrobe of Marie Antoinette. I never gave it back to Iris after that occasion, and I think she forgot all about it. In any case, we were having a busy day that day. We had a lunchtime engagement to get back to. By the time we'd cycled back into Oxford and down the Woodstock Road, we were as hot as we had been earlier that morning, before we had crawled through the dense green undergrowth and discovered the river. Still dripping with sweat and making vague efforts to tidy our hair and clothes, we rang the bell of a flat in Belsire Court. As we waited, we looked at each other expressionlessly, then burst at the same moment into a soundless fit of giggles. Our host, who'd been getting lunch, was quite a time coming to the door. He was a brilliant young doctor with green eyes, called Maurice Charlton. When even younger, he'd been a classics don at Hertford College and considered one of the best in the university. So good, indeed, that he gave it up after 3 years and turned to medicine. He now held a research appointment at the Radcliffe Hospital. He was supposedly rather in love with Iris. That was why he had asked her to lunch. She had told him she was spending the morning with me. We were going to cycle out together to see Cassington Church, and so could I come too? He took it like a man. He had prepared a delicious lunch. The flat was not his own, but belonged to a rich older don at Balliol, with whom he may or may not have had an ambiguous relationship. He seemed to be able to borrow the flat any time, for his friend lived mostly in college when he wasn't away in Italy or Greece. 50 or so years ago, life in the university was more constricted and formal, but at the same time more comfortable and relaxed. For us, in those days, there was no paradox involved. We maintained public standards and conventions, almost without being conscious of them, while leading our own private lives. We worked very hard, at least Iris did. I was more naturally indolent. Maurice Charlton probably worked harder than both of us together. But he was totally relaxed, his green eyes sparkling, and with a delightful air, as soon as he saw us, of collusion in something or other, what he had been doing, what we had been doing. This intimate feel, as if we could become naughty children together any moment, was enhanced by the somber dignity of the flat, full of rare books, good furniture, glass. I still remember the long-stemmed green and white wine glasses, out of which we drank a great deal of very cold hock. I think it was the white wine people usually drank in those days. We had never got to Cassington Church, we said. It had been far too hot. We had cycled back in an exhausted state, and it was wonderful to be here in the cool, drinking the wine. We both said something like this, without looking at each other. Iris jumped to her feet to go over and kiss Maurice Charlton, and it seemed just the right and spontaneous act, making us all three laugh. We two men laughing both at and with Iris, as she gazed delightedly round the dark and, as it seemed, rather mysteriously grand flat, as if she were Alice in Wonderland on the threshold of a new series of adventures. I mentioned the lunch with Maurice Charlton, and that enchanted Sunday morning when Iris and I had our first swim together, because I remember it all very vividly. Not because it had any great importance in itself. Although I had met Charlton a few times and admired him, that lunch was probably our only social occasion together. It was typical of my relations with Iris at that time that I had very little idea of the other people in her life, or what they might mean to her. That was probably due to the ecstatic egoism of falling in love for the first time. For me, it was the first time, although I was not exactly young. Iris was 34, Maurice about the same age. I was 28. Difference in age, which means a good deal at school and not much in later years, was only a part of the atmosphere of that lunch party, because we seemed for the moment like a family, and a family takes such differences in age for granted. Iris never swam fast and noisily or did fancy strokes. It was being in the water that she loved. Twice she came quite close to drowning. I thought of that now, 44 years later, with the anxiety that has now invaded both our lives, as we approach the bank again to scramble out. This had always been a more difficult and inelegant operation than slipping into the river, but it had never bothered us in the past. The river was as deep near the bank as in midstream, the bank itself undercut by the water's flow. It shelved a little in our own corner, the soft clay occasionally imprinted by the hooves of drinking cattle. I pulled myself out first and turned to help Iris. As she took my hand, her face contracted into that look of childlike dread, which so often came over it now, filling me, too, with worry and fear. Suppose her arm muscles failed her, and she slipped back into deep water, forgetting how to swim, and letting water pour into her mouth as she opened it in a soundless appeal to me. I knew, on the spot, that we must never come to bathe here again.